Pseudopod, episode 198, June 11th, 2010. This week's story, The Mother and the Worm, by Tim W. Burke. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. This week's story comes to us from Tim W. Burke, and whilst it's not previously been published, it is a sequel to his previous story here, The Garden and the Mirror. Tim's had an interesting career, and during his time with a comedy group in Philadelphia, was best known for a sketch featuring Muppets, depicting the brains of the Kennedy brothers, who were running the country in secret, in between matches of touch football. Is it just me that finds that oddly reassuring? It is. I'll move on. Tim's work has appeared most recently in the April 2010 issue of Space and Time magazine, and when asked what he wanted to communicate with this story, Tim replied simply, "The key to a good relationship is communication." The narrator this week is Paul Jenkins, the author of the superb novel The Playtone Revisionist, which can be found at playtone.com. So sit down, close your eyes, and hold the hands of the people on either side of you, because I have a story for you, and my spirit guide has promised me it's true.
The Mother and the Worm by Tim W. Burke. We were in our places, Olivia at the door and I in the wicker basket. The windows were concealed with heavy curtains to keep out the afternoon sun, but oil lamps pushed back the gloom. The lady who entered our study first was the old friend of Olivia's family, who embraced Olivia, then introduced her guests. The other matron wore black. She was the hopeful patron. The men were both young, one balding and moustached, and the other dark and intense. They were surprised by her frank smile, by her firm handclasp, and they smirked. The basket that hid me was a cubit square. Within it, I sat naked on a thin cotton mat, waiting for my cue. After brief pleasantries, Olivia bade everyone sit at the mismatched slat chairs around our worn table. Slowly, not without drama, she turned the gas lamps down. "Everyone take hands, please. This afternoon we speak with the spirits. I need for everyone to speak these holy words of the Hindu. Om Mani Padme Hum." Her resonance and theatrics gave the others confidence. The older ladies intoned with Episcopalian reserve. The men seemed strangely comfortable with the trappings and joined in. The chant rose in pitch. This was my cue, as thespians say. I lay back and breathed deep, humid air inflating my months-old lungs. As I inhaled, I imagined the proper yantra symbol. I exhaled my own mantra to release my spirit from my misshapen flesh. "Come to us, Alexandri. Come to us, spirits." I continued my chant and let myself drift, imagining myself in warm black oil. As she implored, the study was swallowed by the warm oil. My spirit rose from the basket. My hands glowed, my fingers lithe. My spirit body shone golden and tall, like before I had forced myself into Thomas Spalding's brain and was reborn in the mannequin shape. The bodies of the attendants glowed with auras of life. Rainbows flared along the older women. The bald man's was a healthy bronze. The young man's was odd. The flares were violet and tight, like a gas burner pressed by a weight. Olivia's lavender opened and extended across the room as she entered her trance, so that she could communicate with the spirit realm. Unseen by the others, I drifted to Olivia and caressed her neck. Touching her spirit was like touching soothing wool on a winter day. Feeling me, her head eased back and magenta sparks streaked her neck after my fingertips. She said, "My spirit guide is with us. Are you ready to help us, Guru?" Her head fell forward and she affected a deeper, thicker-tongued man's voice, an impersonation of me when I was human. "Olivia, I am always pleased to make new acquaintances. These are charming people." She sighed and rolled in her seat, as if buffeted by forces within. In her voice, "I sense a presence with you, Guru. Who is with you?" I had been too distracted by Olivia to notice. A disembodied glow had appeared by one of the women. It was the size of a grown man and boiled red. It pointed to the older woman. Came a voice from the spirit. "Could you tell my blasted wife to get to a blasted doctor?" The guests could not hear him. Olivia's trance had attuned her to the request. Olivia did a charming impression of him, pretending that he was speaking through her. I felt she could just convey the message. But she was right in that the impression added drama. The women's auras paled and exploded with excitement. "It is him! It is him! Oh, Morton, I knew you were near me! My dear, it is a miracle! Livy, you do have a gift!" I looked to the widow and saw that, yes, on her shin there was a black spot of disease the length and width of a pencil. Peering closer, I increased my perception so that the black spot was like a growth of black fungus on a great oak. I recognised the illness. I told Olivia, she has cancer of the bone in her right shin. The husband had choice words for his grieving widow. The dead are practical. The widow wept with gratitude. In hysterical gulps, she confessed that in her melancholy she had been neglecting an ache she thought was rheumatoid. She cried out a promise to see a physician immediately. This was the rare good deed. The husband's concern allayed, the widow enthused to live on, a new patron for Olivia and me, a small work toward atoning for our evil to Thomas Spalding. The young, intense man spoke. "Yes, Mrs. Spalding, I would like to speak with my mother, Esther Weissel. I am Eric Wardrow, at your service." The ladies stirred and cooed. Even Olivia took a breath. Eric Wardrow, the world-renowned magician and escape artist, had started performing at the Orpheum this weekend past, on what his posters called a globe-spanning tour of the continents. Wardrow made teams of horses disappear, escaped from iron trunks submerged in water, challenged local police departments to keep him imprisoned. She glanced at where she knew she could catch my eye. The glimpse of onyx was like lightning, and I knew she thought the same. We had read in the newspapers that Wardrow's mother had died 5 months ago, and he spent his considerable resources going to mediums in hope of contacting her spirit. Every week there was a report of a fraudulent medium Wardrow had exposed. He said, "It is remarkable how you helped my agent's aunt." "Thank you. I have a gift, and I thought I could help the friend of a friend." "You are the Olivia Spalding whose husband Thomas had died in a fire in New York City?" "Yes." "Do you speak with him?" "Sometimes. When times seem dark, I turn to him for assurance." She had to say things like that. In fact, we contacted very few spirits, as the majority of souls reincarnated into other living creatures. Thomas was doubtless in a lower form of life, atoning for having murdered me for my affair with Olivia. "Is he with us now?" "There is a part of him always near, Mr. Wardrow." It was a biting joke of hers that I did not care for. "Sadly," she continued, "I sense no other presence with us." I looked closely at him, unseen by all except Olivia. No injuries or diseases marred his aura. The man beside Eric trembled, feeling the chill of my presence. Wardrow's voice was an oboe played by a virtuoso. "So you are saying you cannot contact just any spirit?" "Mr. Wardrow, the spirits are all around us. They transcend and reincarnate as karma dictates, providing they wish to work within karma. What I am saying is that for some reason known only to your mother and the universe, your mother will not be contacted." "That's a fine splitting of hairs, Mrs. Spalding. You are a medium, but only not with my mother's spirit." "Convenient." Her smile pulled tight. "I understand your scepticism, but the spirits do not wait for us to yank them away from the afterlife so that we may speak with them. Only a few stay on earth. Her husband has worried about her in life. He worries for her now." Eric shook his head and frowned. "My mother loved me. She saw me through my career. On her deathbed, I made my mother promise to do everything she could to return. My mother would not lie." "I do not deny that. I sense that you are a very loving man. Perhaps your mother has transcended to a higher plane. Perhaps she finds it better for you if she did not communicate. An intriguing insight. Wardrow joined the others at the parlour door. When it opened, it cut the auras away and made his spite all the more visible. I will be in touch with my agent's aunt, and she will tell me if the doctor finds anything wrong with her shin. I will let you know immediately of the finding. Then I'll tell the newspapers. Please do. The widow turned to the balding man. Billy, really, Mrs. Spaulding is a friend. The beleaguered agent led the ladies out the door. Olivia turned up the gaslight and closed the door. She looked out the window to make sure the visitors had departed. I returned my spirit to the body in the basket. Cold air eased into my lungs. A knock shook the darkness. Alexandri, she whispered. It frightened her to see me in the coma when my soul was elsewhere. I am here. My voice was now a frog's croak. Above me, she opened the lid and offered a doll's cup of oolong. I accepted it. The poor woman, her husband dying suddenly, now cancer, I suspect she will be visiting us again. Without a leg at the least, if not more. Her jokes bit back her fears. She had lost her family as a child. The only two things that frightened her were death and solitude. She asked, "But what of Wardrow? If we put him off, his responsibilities will take him away." Unfolding a doll's silk robe, she handed it to me. "We will be known for not taking his challenge. We have good reason. But what an opportunity! If he can be impressed, then our fortunes would be secure." An offered hand helped me from the basket onto the plain wood floor. Her enthusiasm puzzled me. She had left Boston under a cloud of scandal. Though her hand in her husband's death wasn't proven, her husband's family had all but disowned her. I said, "We have far more attention than I like as it is. We could pick and choose our patrons, live in more comfortable accommodations. If I am discovered, the truth will be known. I shall will myself to die before I am captured, but it would be the gallows for you." "I believe I can handle Mr. Wardrow. Did you hear his accent? He's as European as a Chicago stockyard. I understand him." My disbelief must have showed, for she added, "We are talented people who have to hide our truths. You are the same. You should sympathize with him." I never had to hide anything until I had met her. "Leave him alone, Olivia. It is too much risk." We ate, and I led her through yoga and meditation. She disrobed, and I projected my spirit, and we engaged in tantra. The touch of spirit was not itself more spiritual lovemaking, only different. I rejoined my body and climbed into bed with her. She said, "Your visits leave me hungry for your touch, as you had been." "It is enough that I can be here with you," I said in her ear. "You have read how reality is illusion, that your body is illusion. You can learn to reshape your body, or create and inhabit a new one. I read about Guru Marku. He created a body through concentration. His wife merged with him physically when she died, so they were always together, forever." I had read. She knew such a thing was far beyond my knowledge. I rubbed my fingertips. I missed having the grain of fingerprints. She leaned to me, looked into my eyes. "Wardrow could gain us resources that would help make good our transgressions. We could travel like we had planned. Go to Asia and find someone who could make you whole." Whole. This was the body with which I defied death for her. She did sleep with my new body beside her. She curled around me, but always at arm's length. The next afternoon there came a knock on our door. Wardrow stood in the doorway, eyeing her with undisguised amusement. "You have caught my interest. Billy's aunt does have cancer of the bone. Her leg will be amputated." "That is terrible. I am so sorry." "She cannot wait to see you again." "Neither could you," I thought. They sat and chatted about his travels. She encouraged him to speak about his tour of Europe, which he did with the poise of a reflexive performer. Soon they were calling one another by first names. but whenever Wardrow asked of her past, she answered in generalities and guided the conversation elsewhere. He sipped his tea nonchalantly, trying to approach as a peer. "How do you know about Billy's aunt?" "Her husband told me." He snorted. "Come on. Was it something in her limp? Are you paying someone in her household?" "Paid a maid to peer into flesh? If so, you're better off speaking to the maid, aren't you?" She smiled, tight and polished, and folded her hands in her lap. "I mean no insult, but there's a trick here, Olivia." That glow was back in her eyes, the dark wonder, the look she had when I emerged. Her smile did not change. "What of your promise to tell the newspapers of my success?" "I'm holding off on that until I can have a repeat performance." "Ah. If you can show me more, I can deliver more." He looked around the room. Simple enough for our needs, but I had noted Olivia's disdain. "A woman of your breeding deserves more. If you show me, I can help you." "I am not a show horse, for all my breeding." "Again, I mean no disrespect. Could you explain your metaphysics, then? How did you acquire your ability?" She explained how she and her husband had retained me to teach her husband to shrink his tumour. How the success of the learning had helped her husband regain his health. She omitted her affair with me, her husband's murdering me and the subsequent cover-up, and how I came to be reborn. Olivia accepted his invitation to see his performance from the governor's box at the Orpheum. I watched the performance in spirit. On stage, Eric's aura fanned across the twinkling audience. His charm and command made his most subtle movements thrilling. But removed from the charm, the tricks spoke of Eric's soul. Concealments of not just a rabbit, but a team of horses. The sawing of a beautiful woman and her seeming resurrection. An escape from a straitjacket while hanging by his feet over a bed of nails, done before a candle burned through the rope. The humility that masked a juggernaut of will. She knew that I had watched, especially when she went backstage and spoke with him, each hushed and in seeming awe of each other. She had whispered to him, "This must be kept secret." "My life is made of well-kept secrets. I learned everything I know by keeping confidences." So it was that she introduced Wardrow to Tantra. Her Tantra was masterful, with the Yantra patterns my family had passed through generations. With them entwined, she could coax his energy to a higher state. He kept glancing to me, not believing. Olivia noticed him. Sweating, she asked, "You do not imagine. What do you see?" I see someone watching, a tall, golden man." Olivia smiled and touched his strong, dimpled chin. "That is Alexandre, my spirit guide." "He looks so angry." "Did I?" She continued the rhythm to bliss. "Concentrate on the patterns, on my sensations. Repeat the mantra. You will hear him. He speaks to you." I had hoped she was right about bringing Wardrow this far. "Eric," I said. Wide-eyed, he nodded. "Yes." "You sought proof, Eric. Follow me and you shall have your proof." I extended my hand into his arm and led his spirit out of the flesh. For all her proficiencies, Olivia would not follow here. The one time she had succeeded in becoming spirit, she had seen her comatose form. She returned to flesh and lay in bed trembling for hours. I guided him by thought. I imagined his agent, the nephew Billy, who had sensed my presence. We flew over the city, over the people sparkling with life. We came to the Grand Hotel, beside the Orpheum. Off the lobby of the hotel was a barbershop. Wardrow's companion from the other day, Billy the beleaguered nephew, was also Eric's agent. Unaccustomed to spirit travel, Eric reeled about the room, peering at details in the mirror frame, astonished not to see his reflection in the glass. Wondering at the smells of the bottle of lilac water, how could he smell with no nose? His joy of discovery was charming and, grudgingly, winning. I beckoned him back to his agent's chair. Billy the agent sat smoking one of the better-smelling cigars, chatting with the other men. He ruffled the pages of the Police Gazette. "It's a bit brisk in here." "I'm warm myself," said a man. I told Eric, "Your agent is sensitive. He would make a good mystic." Eric considered. He seems to know how people tick. Say he thought he heard whispers in the dark during the seance. The agent set his cigar in an ashtray. Where would be a good place for a steak? The men discussed chop houses. Eric, here is your proof. Think of a food, then whisper it in his ear. Eric lit up in delight and whispered. The agent puzzled, then thanked the men for their suggestions. Know this, Eric. If we cannot find your mother, she does not want to be found. Do you understand? It is all so much, but I don't understand. I made her promise. She promised. I led Eric back to my lover's bed. His body lay, eyes closed, breaths long and shallow. Olivia sat beside him, naked, meditating in the lamplight, her fingers twisted anxiously on her knee. His eyes blinked open. My God, that couldn't have been real, could it? Olivia opened her eyes and smiled, and stroked his thigh. The next morning, after he had left for his performance, there was frantic knocking on our apartment door. Eric burst in. I had to cancel my performance for tonight. I can't concentrate. What happened? Olivia said. This morning, I asked my manager what he had been up to last night, and he told me this and the other thing. Then he said, oh, I also went to the barbershop in the lobby and jawed with some boys and read the Police Gazette. By the by, I've been craving kippers since then. Let's go eat at the wharf. I told him kippers. He asked me, what are you laughing about? And I ran to a cab to see you. She is out there somewhere. I have to speak with her. She'd be so happy. I want her to know that her sacrifice is paid, and I am performing in the Orpheum in San Francisco. She will not be found. Someone with your ability could spy and influence leaders across the globe. But what I don't understand is why you cannot find my mother. Exasperated, Olivia shook her head. You have exposed some charlatans, and the world is better for it. Now I wonder how many legitimate mediums you have ruined due to your mother's inconvenience. Eric wheedled. He promised her riches, security, privacy, fame, anything she wished. Tomorrow I tell my manager. Then I will come for you and make you safe. She narrowed her eyes. She drew closer to him. It is all so sudden. It frightens me. He departed to perform, leaving with one last kiss. She turned to face my basket, sullen. I pushed open the lid. Are you sincere that you will not have him, or do you play us both? She gasped, you helped me. You believed having him see the truth was best. I hoped he would understand and give up his quest for his mother. We should have just shown him the door. He is a showman. There is no such thing as a silent personal epiphany. There is no escaping this. I sat on the floor, deflated. I could leave. I could just will myself to die. I am supposed to be dead. There is no way I can atone for killing your husband. I will start the cycle anew, as an insect. My, wouldn't that be best? You leave me, and I'd swell around the world being the kept woman of a well-paid fraud. I hadn't noticed how bitter her voice had become over these past weeks. Perhaps he'd even let me do seances. Because once he's discovered I can't help him find his mother, then I'm just a bit of stuff, aren't I? You wouldn't care a whit. For all her fear, her sharpness stung. But I held my temper. I will not kill again. One death is too many. Could you compel him to forget? With so much around to remind him, his agent, his agent's aunt, he is going to destroy us. This is why I didn't want attention. I can't live picking lice like some wog fakir. The epithet was enough. At that moment, I hated her more than I hated anything. My heritage, my loneliness, my desperation. She, of all people, had to be the one who understood me. So, late that night, I visited Wardrow. I ascended and flew and found him in his suite at the Grand. I whispered in his ear. I encouraged him to remember Olivia. To remember the mantra. To imagine himself floating above his body. He was beside me, blue and flaring. If you are true, then take me to my mother. As you wish. For now, you must lead me. Imagine your mother's grave. Out of the city, over a desert, through the dark of a mountain, then another. Eric marvelled at it. So much to see, so much we could do. He led me to a quiet, groomed glade. Stone angels wept over the granite monument. Esther Weisel, loving mother. Wardrow looked around the cemetery and called in Yiddish, "Mother! Mother! Where are you?" "You will find your mother in a more subtle place. Follow." Now I led him. I brought him to drift into the earth, down until we found the dry wood of her coffin. Her eyes had collapsed. Her skin trembled with worms. Wardrow's soul flamed. "How dare you profane her rest? Why am I here?" Profaning a love coming from him, that was indeed rich. I said, "There is a greater lesson here, Eric. Follow me. Know the essence of your love." Pulling him forward and to a smaller destination, our perceptions increased to better see the tingling and humming life in the casket. "This is horrible. Wait, I had almost lost you." "My apologies. Look at the worms, Eric. See how they glow with life, like jewels. Aren't even the smallest lives beautiful?" His mother had a burial shroud fit for a princess. His complaints faltered. "They are still worms, and this is still a grave. I demand my mother's spirit." "Closer, Eric." I led him to bring his perception closer, like I had with the aunt's cancer, until the worms were to us as glowing dragons. "Do you see the four dim boulders fitted together like a cross?" We had seen thousands of such on his mother. I concentrated myself still smaller and farther still. "Wait, don't leave me, I'll follow." Four boulders now towered like mausoleums. Their light grew to that of a coming dawn. "Eric, these are eggs." "Why are they becoming brighter?" He was more in the spirit of the surroundings. I gave him merit for it. "These will be born in a day." I extended a perfect golden hand. "Come within, follow." "Inside the egg? Outrageous! You promised my mother." "One step further, then no more. You will be reunited with your mother." "Her, here, as a worm? This can't be so. Mother, are you here?" He was still calling when he entered the egg. The egg, now possessing a soul, grew bright. "Eat well, Eric Weisel." The egg coruscated like fireworks. Wardrow's soul battered against the maze of flesh. The colour flamed from the red of a furnace. For hours he raged. The escape artist determined to find his way out of the bonds that grew tight around him, and finally into him. I could feel the sun rising above. And still he raged. Well into the morning, his egg was glowing brightly like the three others, as bright as the worms around us. Eric's egg split. He flexed sightlessly onto his mother's skin. He rolled free and tapped his mouth against the new world. The bright white of the worm life still sparked and shot with red and deep blue. Had he died naturally, Eric might have been reborn a worm, but would have had only the merest memory of Eric. That memory would have quickly faded as he entered the business of being a worm. Crimson, his worm mouth cringed from the skin. But Eric was now an abomination, like me. Placing himself into living flesh, he would have to live the way of the worm, but never forgetting he was Eric, and know that he was eating his mother's flesh. The worm had the merest dimple beneath its mouth. A sprig on each side waved. His new body would even try to conform to the shape of his soul. His face may eventually emerge. The sprigs become arms. Who knew how large his body may grow? But here, under 6 feet of dirt, no one would see what horror had spawned in Esther Weisel's grave. No, not horror, enlightenment. The worm turned the colour of a winter sky. It was only a matter of one need overwhelming the other. Worms live for 8 years. Eric's comatose body would waste away in a hospital and die long before that. With a last twist, Eric blindly bit into his mother. Then, within me, deep within, I felt a presence. It said, "Join him. Atone. Enter the joy of life anew." Around me was a constellation of the true and the reel. The worm bit and bit again. Said the voice, "He will outlive this. He will overcome this fate and live again greater than before. But you have removed yourself from karma and are less than a worm." I did not dare ask who spoke to me. Was it Esther? I declared, "I will not leave Olivia." Daylight thundered past me like a roller coaster. Cold air whooped into my lungs. I rolled onto my side and coughed thin phlegm. My shoulder was scratched raw against the rattan mat. My pulse pounded my ears. I had been carried into the sitting room. Olivia's eyes shone with tears. "You're back! You're back!" And she took my mottled blue hand in her fingers and pressed it to her lips and lay her cheek upon it. Her black hair smelled of jasmine soap, sweat, and dust. She cried in anger. "Where did you go? Why did you leave me?" I had imagined the night before what I was going to say. "Eric is enlightened." But the voice in the grave had made a mockery of that claim. There must have been so many other ways to have removed Eric from our lives, but I did not think of them. Finally, I said, "Eric is with his mother. His manager had come and said Eric had taken ill, but no one..." She paled. "You did not kill him." "No, he is with his mother, but I have done evil." She saw my despair. She said, "I believe I could guess." It struck me, Eric's inspiration of guiding others into health and peace. It would be like playing mystic to patrons, but we could weed out the corrupt and encourage the righteous. Then she touched my cheek and looked into my eyes. Onyx lightning caught my soul. This must work. For her sake, this must work. She smiled and kissed my misshapen lips.
There's a British comic called 2000 AD, which is something of an institution. For over 1,000 weeks, it's put out stories about mutant bounty hunters, brutal police officers in one of the last cities left on Earth, the dinosaurs being harvested to provide the foodstuff of the future, and a remarkably cheerful undead sociopath with a pet nanostorm. It's brilliant. Always inventive, always grim, and at times extremely affecting. If you're interested, I'd recommend Strontium Dog, the story of the mutants of England becoming galactic bounty hunters, Nikolai Dante, about a renegade swashbuckler in a future where the Russian Tsars ruled through nanotechnology, and Stickleback, about a very different version of Victorian London and a man who is one part Moriarty, one part Churchill. There's a ton of graphic novel collections of old and new stuff out, and trust me, the vast majority of it is utterly worth your time. For me, though, the comic's at its best with Future Shocks. These are single-part science fiction or horror stories that normally have a sting in the tail, and it's Future Shocks that 2000 AD has traditionally used as a training ground for its new writers. If you can set up a world, characters, tell a story, and pull off a convincing ending in less than 10 pages, chances are you've got the ability to do something longer, and some of the best comic writers in the world got their start there. Alan Moore, Garth Ennis, Grant Morrison, John Smith, Robbie Morrison, Al Ewing, and more all focused their craft on stories designed to surprise, entertain, or terrify. That last really came to the fore around the time I was coming up to the right age for 2000 AD, which was, of course, about 6 years after I'd started reading it. It was the mid-90s, the X-Files were just starting to get huge, and Future Shocks gradually expanded into Terror Tales, a different, darker take on the format, and Vector 13, which placed the stories in a single, cohesive narrative. It was, I think, a Vector 13 story that was one of my first exposures to the feeling you get when you read genuine, skin-crawling horror. The story presented, and my research hasn't been able to confirm this is true, the idea that Guglielmo Marconi became interested in telecommunications, not to talk to other countries, but to talk to the dead, specifically his brother. And in the story, Marconi succeeds. And his brother tells him, in one line, enough about the afterlife to crush Marconi, destroying his faith forever and leading him to bury the device. That line, which I cannot reveal here and do it justice, landed in my head sometime between my 14th and 16th birthday, and it's still there. I distinctly remember reading the story over and over again, always circling back to that last panel in case, somehow, the message was different. It never was. That's the sort of horror Tim presents here. The idea that what lies beyond isn't something we ever want to know or want to be part of. That out beyond the firelight is where the wild things play and scream and hunt and kill. This is a world where mediums don't so much communicate with the dead as censor what they have to say. And the fact Tim finds a tiny measure of hope, of sacrifice in the final lines, shows that every now and again, the choices we make out in the dark aren't wrong. Or at the very least, are right enough to make a difference. Much like our constant galactica-like search for donations, we rely on you to both avoid the Cylon menace and pay our authors and cover our server costs. So if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. We promise the entire ragtag fugitive fleet will salute you. Well, Ben and I certainly will. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod would like to introduce you to Team Free Will, one ex-blood junkie, one dropout with $6 to his name, and Mr. Comatose over there. It's awesome.